Lend me your ears, the Oral Dramaturgies podcast. The Gallery, interviews with artists.
Hello, and welcome to The Gallery. Our guest today has come to theatre making via a stellar career in the music industry, working with the likes of Bjork, Damon Albarn, Lily Allen, Jarvis Cocker, Imogen Heap, and Ed Sheeran. He has been a world looping champion, a co-founder of the Beatbox Academy at Battersea Arts Centre, and the first ever non-classical musician to be given the position of artist in residence at the South Bank Centre in London. Born into a Jewish Iraqi family in the UK, S.K. Shlomo is no stranger to storytelling, only his particular style has been honed through a lifetime of virtuosic practice as a percussionist, beatboxer and producer, all seasoned with a smile and a glint in his eye. In this interview, we learn about how he discovered his rapport with the audience, his particular way of developing narrative material through recordings and live performance, and how he dreamt up and brought to life the concept of rave theatre. S.K. Shlomo is one of the four artists selected in partnership with Battersea Arts Centre to be supported by the Oral Dramaturgies Project. This interview took place via Skype on the 10th of March 2020.
Shall we start with then you telling us about you in whatever way you like? I mean, we've heard about you through the shows and through, you know, how you presented yourself so far. But in terms of how you developed as an artist?
Well, I was always really, really into the music. And like throughout my whole childhood and teen years, I was playing lots of music, like as a percussionist and a drummer. And my dad's a jazz musician, so I used to play two or three gigs in his quartet a week when I was in my teens. So that got me a bit of money, and then I started joining other bands in my teens. So I was gigging most nights of the week, like the last sort of two or three years I was home. And then when I left home, I was 18, and I went to Leeds in the north, which is like a real music kind of city. I went to go and study physics with astrophysics, which was very different to the music in my heart.
When was that? What years?
2002, I left home. But it was the perfect place for me because there was a real music scene there. And the first time I lived somewhere where there was a real scene. So I started like jumping on microphones and just trying to get as much experience as I could on stage as a beatboxer.
Whereabouts in Leeds did you go to, and where was this sort of happening?
I need to remember some of the venues. There was a venue called The Wardrobe, another one called The Basement. And there was the two universities both had venues, the Leeds Uni and the Leeds Met Uni. So I do a lot of gigs around those parts. And then through that, outside a rave, I met a guy who was in a hip hop band, and then he invited me to join the band. And through that, we started touring first in the UK, and then we started touring internationally. They're called Foreign Beggars, really, really underground. Based in London, but a very kind of international group, like everyone was from different backgrounds, hence being called Foreign Beggars. So they loved it that I was foreign. And that was a real big deal for me because I'd always felt like a bit of an outsider being from an immigrant family. But this new world was like, it was your job to be different. And that was really lovely. And I was so young, I was like 19. And these guys never asked me any questions about, they're like, what's your name? I was like, Shlomo. And they were like, cool, that's just what they called me. There wasn't any like, well, what does that mean? What's your real name? Where are you from? There wasn't any of that. It was just like, cool, let's just be together. Let's just make music.
So did your sort of music career take off before you finished your degree? Is that what happened?
Or no, I didn't finish the degree. I think I officially was enrolled for the whole of the first year, but I wasn't going in. I was getting on the mic every night. And then after that first year, I couldn't convince them anymore that I was going to change my ways. So I had to leave. And I was thinking of maybe trying to move to a music course at Leeds College of Music or something like that. But it was like too late in the year. So I went and got like a day job, like a temp job. And then I left the temp job. I remember what happened because I got offered this job in the summer from Leeds City Council teaching beatbox workshops for 6 weeks. And I was like, great. So I quit the day job. I showed up on the first day and they were like, oh, no, it's not 6 weeks, it's six workshops, one every week. And I was like, oh, no, I've just quit my job. But then I just decided if I could earn as much money this week as I would have done in the day job, then I'll stay. You know, I won't go back to work. And then I've managed to do that since, so that's good. So that was 2004 that I left the day job. And then that same summer, I worked with Bjork, who was making an all-vocal album. And she'd heard some of the demos that I'd put online. which I just made by like phoning up music studios in Leeds and saying, oh, I'm a beatboxer, can we make a demo? And some of them were like, oh, this will cost you this, this will cost you that. And one of the guy was like, you do what? You better come in and have a cup of tea. And then he ended up kind of mentoring me a bit and introducing me to a lot of the industry around Leeds.
And who was this guy? Can we know?
He's called Bruce Word, and he had a studio called Touchwood. And there's a Leeds band called Nightmares on Wax who were really successful. They started out with him, so he kind of introduced me to all those guys.
And at what point did you meet the foreign beggars? What, which year was that?
That would have been straight away, like 2002, in the first few weeks of me being there. And then, yeah, after the Bjork thing, people started wanting to book me rather than foreign beggars. So then I started trying to do my own stuff, and like I started looping. So I got a pedal so I could live loop and make my own music, rather than just, because up until then I was just basically copying like famous songs, like doing Snoop Dogg and doing Missy Elliott and all these songs. But I wasn't really, I didn't really think of it as creation. I just thought of it as a trick and a fun way to get people excited. But then when I worked with Bjork, she just wanted to make music. And I was like, oh yeah, that's such a cool idea. Like, I make music. Why am I not bringing these two worlds together? So I then decided to take my solo career really seriously. And then I did a TV performance in 2005 on BBC Two. It was a show called Later with Jules Holland. Getting on that show was such a big deal. Like, that was boom, like proper mainstream music industry exposure.
It sounds like the Bjork incident was quite a significant one. What was it that drew her to your work?
Well, she was making an album that was all voice. It was kind of a concept album. It was called Medulla. And she'd already recorded the album, and she'd used various different people. But there was a beatboxer called Razel from America who'd been like my hero, my whole generation's hero. And he'd done most of the work. And then she had this other track that wasn't going to go on the album, right? It was a commission for the Athens Olympics in 2004. She was going to perform it at the opening ceremony. And she'd already finished recording the album, and then she decided she wanted to put this song on the album as well, which meant if it was going to fit with the album, it would have to be all vocal. So she decided to re-record it, and they were mixing in the UK. So I think she literally just typed into Google beatboxing UK, and my website came up, and she listened to it, and she was like, great, let's book that guy. Yeah, so I was kind of lucky in that way. I was quite entrepreneurial, and I had a really, at the time, like having a website was quite a big deal, but I had a really good website and had like, just, you know what I mean? Like I had my shit together to a level that a lot of people, like 20-year-olds, just didn't have.
I would also observe from that you were quite tech savvy. What was that journey then towards making The Beast?
Well, I got into the looping and using technology in my show in a way because I wanted to expand my solo act. I wanted to keep it all vocal, but I wanted to have more than just what I could do in one take. And then I guess you got to skip forward a few years, because it was 2010. I entered the UK Looping Championships for fun. I entered it for fun. I saw it come up. I was like, that looks like fun. I entered that, got into the finals, and then won the UK finals, which meant I went to LA to represent the UK in the world finals. And then I won that. So then I was like, okay, now I'm like a world champion. And that day, it was posted at this big international music conference called NAMM, which is like the annual event where all the music companies show off their new equipment. And they've all got these like stands. It's like this massive conference. So I went round all of these stands, and I was like, oh, I've just become like world looping champion. And everyone was super interested in that, and they wanted me to try out all their equipment. So I got home and people started sending me all of this tech. So then I had all this equipment, which was really, really powerful, but it was so cumbersome and it was really messy. And every time you plug one piece of hardware into another, you start having more and more degradation of the audio quality, and it's harder to get them to synchronize together. And it just got more and more messy and complicated. And I was getting more frustrated. And I thought, well, I want to make my own thing. I'd kind of created this hybrid software hardware setup and trying to synchronize the two together. But there's the software I was using is called Ableton Live, which is like a really popular music software. And it's great for live electronic music. But you can also get this thing called Max for Live, which is a kind of programming language which integrates with Ableton. And it means you can hack it. So you can hack the software, but you can also hack the hardware. So I was using physical controller, and you could hack it so you could change how it works and what the buttons do and when they light up and why and all the logic behind it. And so I kind of asked for some advice because when I first started to do it, I was just like, I can't do this. It's really like, have you ever tried writing code? It's like, if you don't know what you're doing, it's just like words that just don't mean anything. But I got some mentorship and I got some advice and I got some help. And then eventually I kind of broke through the seal of doubt and then I was off. I could make it do it.
And what did you need it to do that it wasn't doing already?
Well, initially I was trying to emulate the hardware. There was probably about four main pieces of hardware in my setup that each did different jobs. And I wanted to emulate that with the software so that it would all happen in one place in the computer.
And what were the four pieces of hardware that you were using up until then?
The main one's called the Loop Station, which was a similar piece of kit that I'd been using right back since the beginning. But I'd been using all the more modern versions of them as they came out and they got more and more powerful. And then I had another one called a Chaos Pad, which is a really powerful effects unit. It has like an XY touch screen, so you can control two effects with one finger by going up and down effects one parameter and left and right effects another. I had another big effects unit with all different vocal effects to kind of manipulate my voice. So what I wanted to do was do all of that with the computer so it all happened in one place. One of my rules if I was going to use software was that I would never touch the laptop. Because I was always really physical with the hardware. Like I used to come off stage and my knuckles would be bleeding because I'd like, they're not really built to use your hands with. They're built, the ones I was using at the beginning, were they're like foot pedals. They're designed for guitar players. And I'd be like smashing them. And I never wanted to lose that physicality, like, because a lot of people use touchscreens and things like that, but they're so delicate. And I wanted to be able to like keep that kind of quite aggressive, quite violent kind of drama to the performance.
So that's good. So I was going to actually backtrack a little bit because this is the technological strand that's important. You talked to us about how your interest in music has evolved. And then you've just talked to us about how your journey towards sort of working with different hardware and software has come about. And actually, it's quite interesting that you said you studied physics because that's also part of that journey in some way in my head. And then there's this other thing that you touched on, which was about teaching beatboxing in Leeds. I don't know whether that's sort of a strand that leads towards your work with the Beatbox Academy in Battersea Arts Centre. Where was it in Leeds that you taught beatboxing?
I started doing workshops really early on, like trying to remember exactly the story. I think, so you know I told you about Bruce who had the studio. He introduced me to Leeds City Council because they had an annual music competition called Bright Young Things or something like that. And they wanted someone to host the gigs. So those were some of my first paid gigs. I would go on stage and I'd do some beatboxing and then I'd introduce the bands and I'd get the crowd hyped.
And where did that take place?
So it was in Leeds City Centre, various venues in there, like one called Northern Lights, and one called, oh, I need to try and remember where they all were. I can find out if you want to know. But these were my first like professional gigs, really. Through that, I kind of got into working with Leeds City Council and they asked me to do these workshops over the summer. And it was like, there were six workshops in six different parks, basically, like Roundhay Park and all these different Hyde Park, different parks around the city, just trying to engage with the kids and the young people who are kind of hanging around all summer with nothing to do and get them making music. The teaching thing happened right at the beginning and kind of grew in parallel with my own practice. And I always really loved teaching because when someone asks you how you do it and you have to explain it, like you actually think about your practice in a way that you don't always notice when you're just performing. You're like, well, how do I do that? And that makes you really think step by step how you're actually doing it, and that's a really helpful process for your own learning. So I always loved that. And then the BAC thing wasn't that far forward from that. It's like, I think the first gig I did there was 2006 or something like that. I think I did a one-off gig there and it sold out and we were like, okay, we need to do more. So then we did like a whole weekender where I took over the building for a weekend, and the idea was we'd engage the community. So we started going into schools and just doing little workshops, and I brought some of my friends in to do that with me, like Zany, and various people kind of got involved, and then brought Comrade in, and then we were like, this is amazing, we need to formalize this. So then we called it the Beatbox Academy and we never looked back.
So have you been as closely involved with it as Conrad has since then?
Or? Yeah, I stopped teaching at the Beatbox Academy quite gradually, and then Comrade kind of took the lead. Originally it was me, Zany, a guy called Jez, Comrade, and a lady called Monique. Jez moved to Italy Monique moved to the other side of London. Zany, he's like a world champion beatboxer, so he was always on tour. And I was always on tour as well, so it was just really hard. But Comrade stayed. He became the director of it and became the center of it. And I'd kind of have more of a consultant role. And then these days, I'm not really involved at all, apart from just being very proud.
Yes. Would you say that was your sort of first crossover with theatre making? Or was there any other path towards now wanting yeah. to make a theatre show?
Yeah, there was a real key turning point for me, which was I got offered to do a gig at South Bank Centre in the Queen Elizabeth Hall. And I got asked to curate a whole beatboxing event. That was 2006, around the same time. Yeah, the BAC gig would have also been 2006, I think, and that was my first headline show in London, and that sold out. But this gig at the South Bank also sold out, but I wasn't headlining. I performed, but I also booked some of the other key beatboxing people at the time, and Foreign Beggars came and played as well. And it was really weird for all of us because it was our first ever seated gig, like the Queen Elizabeth Hall. I don't know if you've been there, but it's a really grand traditional concert hall, beautiful room with seats, and everyone was sat down. I remember Foreign Beggars hated it because their whole thing is like getting people going absolutely crazy and jumping around, and some of the other beatboxers hated it, but I absolutely loved it. And it's because I realized that I had been talking quite a lot in between songs and just kind of bantering, but normally like it didn't really get much reaction. But at this show, they laughed and I was like, oh, they're listening. And then I was like, wonder what will happen if I just stop and don't say anything. And the whole room just went completely silent. And I was like, oh, this is so much more exciting. The dynamic you can build all the way back up. And I realized that they listened to what I was saying. It's not just about the music. It's about like the whole performance, the whole story behind who you are. It's not just look at these skills I have. It's like, let me take you on a journey. So I really got the bug that day of like creating more narrative storytelling led performances that incorporate the beatboxing and the music, but they're about more than just make some fucking noise. Do you know what I mean? They can be like a bit more delicate or vulnerable or whatever energy I wanted.
And it was primarily like a music gig.
It was a music gig. Yeah, it wasn't a theatre show, it was a gig, but it gave me the bug. And then that same night, I got a phone call from the artistic director of South Bank Centre, Jude Kelly, and she offered me a position as artist in residence, which was like, do you know what I mean? There would never been any non-classical artist do that, especially not something as abstract as beatboxing. It was a huge accolade. Yeah, so then I set up office at South Bank in 2007, and I had a space there, creative space to work from and have meetings from. And I had free reign of the concert halls. So I programmed a whole series of concerts in the QEH, the Queen Elizabeth Hall. Like we did a monthly concert series for a whole year. They all sold out. They were all really, really varied. Like I was working with folk, or I was working with Indian musicians, or I was working with Jamaican music, or like I just wanted to like absorb as much music as I could. Throughout all of that, I was really developing my craft as a sort of storytelling performer. And then the real theatre thing happened, I remember 2011, I had a little baby and I wanted to tell the story of what it felt like to be a dad. And I just won this World Loop Station Championship thing, so I just wanted to talk about all of that. And we put on my first kind of headline tour, and the show was a theatre show, a one-man show called Mouthtronica. And then we toured that, we took it to the Edinburgh Fringe, and the whole run sold out, and it was like, okay, this is a thing. Storytelling, theatrical performance. Yeah, it works.
Yes, there's no time for all that. Too much to fit in. What else have I got? Oh yeah, this thing here is the pitch shifter. The pitch shifter can change the tone of your voice, make it much higher or much deeper, like really, really deep. I just use it for the evil laugh. Again, mostly if you have like a younger sibling or something.
What would you say were the most significant factors in that process? And what was the kind of journey of that? Or how did your craft actually develop in that time?
Well, I did lots of collaboration. So I was kind of working with wildly different genres of music and different disciplines. And I was absorbing all of this. And then every summer I'd be doing festival season. So I'd be taking all these skills and playing to really big crowds. A lot of it's just experience, and just the more shows you've done, the more things have gone wrong that you've survived and you've learned from, and you've added those to your arsenal. And building a following and just kind of creating a vocabulary as a performer. And I mean, at the time, I think I was still quite frustrated though, because I think I was really, what I wanted to do was be a recording artist, but I was too scared to do that. So I was just really obsessed with pushing myself as far as I could as a beatboxer and a vocal artist. That was my obsession, was to like keep breaking boundaries.
You mentioned the vocabulary. I'm really intrigued by that. I'd kind of like to know what you would consider to be your vocabulary. Is that something that kind of you're quite clear about, or is it something that's quite instinctive?
Yeah, I think it's not super defined. It's more like, because my background had been in jazz drumming, and then I also played orchestral percussion, so I had this real open mind. It was kind of genreless in a way, because like beatboxing isn't actually a genre. It's more like an instrument. Yeah, so if you say, oh, I play guitar, that could mean anything. It could mean rock guitar, or it could mean classical guitar, or Latin, or flamenco. It could be a million genres. So I think I was just exploring technique, but also just like crowd. I think I really learned a lot about how to just bring a crowd together and make them feel excited and connected and like they've come on a journey with you. Like, that was a huge deal.
So some sort of improvisational skills.
Hugely. All those shows we did at South Bank would be very raw. Like, we wouldn't rehearse them very much, and we'd just throw some ideas together before and then just take it on stage. So it's like, it's improvisational. And then and I developed this voice as someone who can guide that, who can bring musicians together and kind of in the moment build something from it. And then like, meanwhile, I haven't even mentioned it, but I also had the vocal orchestra, which was my beatboxing ensemble, which went through various stages, but they'd often be with me. So I'd have this like incredible, like all of them were incredible musicians, incredible vocalists, singers and beatboxers. And I could just throw stuff at them.
Tell us about how that started and where and who these people were.
Well, it started in 2007. So this was just as I was gearing up to start this residency at South Bank Centre. And I wanted to organise the World Beatboxing Convention, which had happened a couple of times before. And I was like, I wanted to organise it. I'd also been organising the Beatboxing Championships. So I was still very entrepreneurial at this point. I was still very like making things happen. And I wanted to do the World Beatbox Convention, and we were looking for like a headline act that would appeal to the beatboxers, but also to the wider South Bank Centre audience. And I was like, well, we're going to have to make one then. So we'll make an act. So I was like, let's create the world's first beatboxing choir. That was my dream. And I'd been hanging around with this vocal group called the Swingle Singers, who are like a really traditional vocal group who've been around since the 1960s and won Grammys in the 1960s or whatever, and they kind of do like this jazz classical thing. And I was like, what happens if you take them and you mix them with a bunch of beatboxers? It was an experiment. Through that, like, that was big. That was like, I think there were 13 or 14 people on stage. And then when we started getting offers to tour it, I shrunk it down a bit so it would be less cumbersome, so it was down to like 7 or 8 people. Yeah, and we did loads of shows at South Bank. We did shows at like Glastonbury and big festivals like Latitude Festival, Big Chill, WOMAD, things like that. And that, to be honest, that was kind of like the real, in terms of like audience reach, that was the peak of my career. That was like, do you know what I mean? We're playing to thousands and thousands of people. It was a really exciting time.
When Jude Kelly asked you to come into the South Bank Centre as the artist in residence, what did she say she wanted from you? Like, what was her vision for you being there?
That's a really good question. That's what I asked her, because she was like, do you want to be artist in residence? I was like, yeah, what's that then? And she was like, well, it's up to you. And I was like, no, but what does it mean? What do I do? What do I have to do? Do I make something? She was like, if you like. And I was a bit like, she was just like deliberately super vague about what it meant. One thing she suggested was that I could make a Christmas show, but I didn't know what that meant. I thought she meant like a show about Christmas or something like that. I only understood that a year or two later. She meant a show that could run over Christmas time, a big theatre show.
So I'm kind of identifying these different strands of your influences and your identity as an artist and so on. And there is another one. I mean, I saw your children's show. There is also something quite childlike in Surrender as well, you know, especially yes. in the beginning. You know, and the Jewish Nana story is quite kind of a striking one that seems to be, you know, an important marker of your work in some way, because it kind of recurs, doesn't it? It exists in Surrender, and you, as I understand it, are planning to bring it back into the new work that you're developing.
Yeah, and that piece was also, I made that piece for Maltronica, which was my first theatre show. So it's just, I've reused that piece because it works so well.
Yeah. So, I mean, so there is something about this sort of like when you said Jude Kelly wanted to do a Christmas show, I was thinking, yeah, she was kind of envisaging this sort of like engaging the kids, you know, engaging the families, you know, which you kind of ended up doing with your children's show later. Are you aware of this? Is this a conscious part of your identity as an artist?
Well, to keep it childlike, keep it playful. I guess so, yeah. I remember watching my first gigs when I was a kid, and I'd always love it if they were having fun. Like, if the band were having fun on stage, like, it was just infectious. It was really hard for you not to have fun. Because my dad used to take me into London to, like, South Bank or Barbican, and we'd watch lots of jazz and lots of, like, Latin music and also classical stuff, and I'd always just be, like, fascinated by how fun it looked. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to have fun. So I always try to have fun in my show. Like, I have to be delighted myself, or it, like, what's the point?
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a village called Bourne End in Buckinghamshire, which was like 1 hour from London. It was kind of halfway between London and Oxford, so I could get to London easily. And then in the area, I used to go to music school on Saturdays, and I got a scholarship there when I was about 10 years old. So then I'd go on Saturdays and study and play in orchestras and learn. It was always just like around me. Music was such a big part of what I was doing.
And why drums? Is drums the main instrument then that was there from the beginning? Or was that one of the many instruments that you played?
That was the main instrument from the age of 8 to 18. That was my dream, drumming. But I did play other instruments, like I'd sing and I'd play guitar, bass, piano, stuff like that. Anything with your hands. But drumming was my specialty.
We've touched on both the first part and the second part of our intended interview in terms of, you know, your different journeys towards what you do and then what you do. You know, this idea of making performance that is on the cusp between music making and theatre making. I'm obviously coming at it from theatre, although, of course, you're coming at it from music. So so it's quite interesting to observe how your work comes across as, you know, the one that I've seen, for example, Surrender, as having all these different layers, you know, that is the narrative, the music making, the way in which you use rhythm and melody in the storytelling. Is there a way in which you articulate the way in which you do this? Or is it, again, just an instinctive thing that just happens?
I don't know. I feel like that show, particularly Surrender, was built from such a wide range of inspirations and influences, because there's a chunks of it which are taken from older influences like the beatboxing and the live looping and the talk about my Nana and talking about how I discovered beatboxing and playing at Glastonbury and things like that. And then there's a bunch of music in that show which was much more recent, which was from my album, where I actually did a lot less beatboxing and I really wanted to embrace myself as being a producer and a recording artist and a singer. So then in a lot of that show, I'm not really doing a huge amount of clever performing. I'm just singing, that was a real departure for me. Like, that was a brave step for me to survive and it still be considered to be successful. Like, that was a big deal. That I had like quite strict starting point for that. I was like, I don't want to do any gimmicks. I want the music to be respected. I think I had a bit of a hang up because I would get a lot of people come up to me after my beatboxing and I still do, and they say things like, oh wow, that was amazing, it blew my mind, the music wasn't my thing, but you are amazing and what you do is amazing. And I'm a bit like, well, what does that mean? Like, the music is what I care about. I don't care about like how it's done. I care about what I'm trying to say. I think I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder that I had to prove that my music would stand alone, you know, without using my personality or charisma and without using my virtuosity, just using my voice and my songs. I feel much better about all that now. Now I've gone back to just whatever, like, it doesn't matter. Like, people can take what they want from it. That whole process helped me relax my rules to myself. Like, I was being quite hard on myself. I think all of that came out of insecurity and dislike of myself. And that whole process was really helpful for me to just like understand that you don't have to prove your worth by achievement, and everything you do is fine. It's good. It's beautiful. So this new show is much less strict about how to make it. It's just, well, what am I trying to say? And then all the tools can follow that.
That makes me want to ask a question about the new show. Which section of the Fringe brochure was Surrender in?
Music.
Music. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know what to do, so I just chose music. But I think this new show is going to be in the theatre.
So what is the intention for the new show?
Well, it's the first time I've really defined it as theatre, as a piece of theatre, as opposed to like a gig that's theatrical. Although it is very much still a gig, very much still, it turns into a rave. That was my whole idea. With Surrender in the Fringe, that was the first time I felt like I'd managed to pull together both sides of what I love to do, which is tell a story and host a gig where people get to go crazy. Because ever since that first gig at South Bank when I had the seated crowd, I'd loved being able to tell the story, but the crowd had always said, but we wanted to dance. And it was always awkward. And this show was finally the first time I felt like I'd nailed it, because I told the story. It was very emotional. There was lots of tears. And then every night they kicked their chairs away and they got rid of the chairs and they came back and we raved. And it was like a real celebration of life and celebrating recovery, basically. And that got me really thinking, because that venue I was in was perfect. It was basically a nightclub with some chairs in it. So it was really easy to just move the chairs, but still have like really cool sound and lights. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to create a theatre show that turns into a rave. So with this show, I wanted to tell the true story of how I started hosting raves in my living room when I was in recovery. I'd been off the road for pushing 2 years, and I hadn't gone back to work. I was feeling a lot better, but I wasn't ready to go back to work. And I was like, this is going to be a way to reconnect with this community that I felt isolated from. In this show, I'm going to tell the story, and then the audience will suddenly realize that they are in the story. They are the guests at the rave, and that we're all going to have this party together. And this concept of rave theater, everyone I've said those two words to is just like their ears prick off. They're like, what is that? That sounds cool. I want to go to that.
And what would make it more theater, do you think? What would make it more kind of qualify for the theater section of the Fringe brochure?
Well, I've written a story, and I've got a theatre director to help me bring that to life. Like, I've never done that before. I've had offers to do it before, and I've been like, no, I want to do it because I'm a control freak.
Yeah, because actually the lighting in your shows is very, like the shows that I've seen till now, is very elaborate and very... Do you do all your lighting designs as well?
No, I normally get someone to help with that, but it's almost always quite like last minute, or... It's quite improvised. It's more like a feel rather than a design. Whereas this show, we want to go much more detailed so we can really create worlds with light. And we're going to have hopefully a little bit of set, something really simple, but just like, it's going to be a bit more designed. It's a bit more considered, because I remember the moment when I went to the... So Surrender got nominated for the Edinburgh Fringe Mental Health Award. So I went to the Fringe First Awards where actual Stephen Fry was handing out these awards. And I listened to everyone give their thank you speeches. And they were like, oh, I want to thank my director. I want to thank my producer. I want to thank my designer. And this and this. And I was a bit like, it's just me. It's like me and my partner, who's also my business partner. We co-produced it all ourselves. And she was here and I was up in Edinburgh by myself. And I was like, I need to have a bigger team. I need to have like people around me.
I'm interested in how the writing happens for a show like this one. Maybe we don't know yet about the show you're writing, but we can maybe talk about the shows you've written so far, like Surrender. Was the text that's in it actually written down first or...
No.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, actually, it varies. Actually, Surrender, I kind of built the narrative around a TED talk that I'd written, and that TED talk was very, very scripted, because when I was working with the organizers, they wanted to see a draft and then they wanted to give feedback and they wanted to see a redraft, and it was like very, very structured. And then I worked really hard to internalize the speech so that I didn't have to think. So I like practiced it for weeks and weeks and weeks and got that really tight. So then when I wanted to expand that into an hour, it was already there, like the arc was already there. So I guess I would have, yeah, I was writing stuff down and memorizing it and changing it, but a lot of it was devised, like, and devised on stage as well, like not necessarily rehearsed. It was like I'd start talking on stage and then, you know, I'd start performing, and then, yeah, like all that stuff about the Nana, the piece about my Nana, the belly dance pieces, was devised on stage. Like I kind of knew what I wanted to say, and I went on stage when I was first touring Mouthtronica, so a long time ago. And it would have been like an 8-minute piece. And then I'd listen back to it and be like, oh, come on. And I'd condense it down. And then I did a TV version of it where it had to be 3 minutes. And then it got really, really tight. And then that, boom, that's the kind of solidified version. So it's like devising, but without a director. So the audience becomes my director. Like I just play it. I record every show I do. And I used to listen to every single one and make really detailed notes. Like even like that sharing that you came to in that tiny room, I recorded that on the GoPro. And then whilst that wasn't even a show, we were just talking. But there were some things that I said whilst I was explaining ideas that made everyone laugh that I wasn't planning. I hadn't been like, this is going to be a funny joke. I just said something and everyone laughed. And then I've transcribed that and that's gone into the script. Because it's like, I think I said something about getting a babysitter. Everyone laughed. I was like, boom, that's going in the script. That wasn't even a show. Like, so that's why I film everything, because you've got to try and find, well, what was it that made people laugh? And it can be like articulation is really key, or timing, or the fact that I was surprised. Do you know what I mean? Like, and it's hard to remember those things if you haven't filmed it.
That's very exciting to me, this idea that, you know, the work does not begin with the process of writing down on the page, but it actually gets formed in this, you know, what you've just said about, like, the audience being the director is really insightful, you know, it's really interesting to me.
But that's how my whole thing evolved, like, out of doing open mic nights in Leeds all the way to playing at the South Bank or playing at Glastonbury. Like, I never wrote a script, I just performed and spoke and saw what resonated, and that became more and more tight. Like even like the kids show that you watched, that wasn't scripted, that was from me teaching workshops to kids in Leeds and gradually repeating it and finding which bit made people laugh, which people help people learn quicker, and then that just becomes tighter and tighter and more refined.
Are there any reflexes that you kind of resort to when you are composing live, if you like?
Mm.
So like in hip-hop, presumably, you kind of have a meter that you're working to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was noticing this in Surrender also, that there was sometimes a meter to which you were delivering particular bits of text. Mm. How does that work?
Well, like hip-hop and a lot of electronic music is centered around a loop, unlike classical music where it's like more linear. Electronic music tends to be something that loops and builds up rather than along, and that creates a kind of steady beat and a steady tempo, and that's what makes people tap their feet, and that's what, it's your heartbeat, it comes from your heart, that's where it evolves from, like tribally, isn't it? It's like we all want to unite in a groove. So like I think because I got into the storytelling through the music rather than the other way around, I always just assumed it would be part of the music, so it'd need to go in a groove. And then if there wasn't a groove, if I took the music away, that creates a big contrast. That bit then feels naked. That isn't a bad thing. It's basically, I'm not telling a story, I'm singing a song. I'm just singing a storytelling song, if that makes sense.
Check, check. When I was a kid, there was quite a big Iraqi Jewish community living in London, and my Nana used to host these huge parties. Nana, her real name is Julie. She's about this tall, and she's quite intense. If you ever hear this sound, you know you're in for a good night. On the other hand, Grandpa Josh is the opposite of Nana. He is the most chilled out person you will ever meet. He just spends hours sat in his chair, just radiating happiness, clicking on his worry beads like this. And I remember one of my earliest childhood memories, just sitting watching for hours whilst Grandpa Josh made this amazing music using nothing but his hands and an Arabic drum called a dumbug. We'd always be the first people to arrive at Nana's parties, and you know something's gonna happen because the chairs are all laid out around the outside of the room, and the moment you cross the threshold you can smell the food, and then your aunties start arriving. For some reason there are hundreds of these old women who call themselves your auntie, and every single one of them wants to squeeze your cheeks as hard as she possibly can and tell you that you're the most beautiful human being that ever lived, which after a while you start to believe. And then the band starts playing. That's how I remember it.
To what extent do you feel your work, the way it is, might connect to the cultural heritage that you might have, you know, been exposed to as a child? Are there any storytelling traditions that maybe your grandparents might have kind of fed in at their end?
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Like my grandparents were from Iraq. They would have descended from Bedouin Jews who are like travelers, and they would, you know, they would travel around the desert, and then like a lot of the food that my nanny would cook was like traditional Arabic Jewish food, and a lot of them are these really slow cooked meals, and the reason why is on the Sabbath you're not allowed to start the fire, right? You're not allowed to touch the fire, so they have to start the fire before the sunset on the Friday before the Sabbath starts, and they can't touch the fire again until sunset on Saturday night. So they need to cook food that will sit in the fire for a long, long time. And it was really delicious. But like, there's this whole culture of like the fire and the campfire and the kind of center of your community, wherever you happen to be that day, is there. And you sit around that and you sing and you tell stories and you entertain each other and you dance. I think that is like a real fundamental part of our core, our DNA as human beings. We have evolved in this, to live in these tribes. We just happen to have, in the very, very recent history in terms of evolution, moved into cities and separated ourselves into individual houses where we can't do that every night. And I think that kind of tribal rhythm is central to what I do, like with the looping and the beatboxing and the bass and the kind of pulse of it and the heartbeat of it is all about that kind of connecting humans together through rhythm. Yeah, it's a cultural way to bring people together.
What about Matthew? How did that choice come about, the choice of Matthew's ear as the director?
Well, I've known him for years and years. So when I first joined Foreign Beggars, our first tour that we did, he was on that tour because he was DJing in another group who was supporting us. And he, at the time, was a hip-hop DJ on BBC One Extra, which is a radio station. At the time, it was quite new as well. And yeah, that's how I just knew him, as DJ Excalibur. I didn't know him as a theatre guy. I don't think he did either. And then he kind of, yeah, we stayed in touch over the years, and I kind of watched him gradually become this like award-winning director. And I'd always invite him to see my work, and he'd always have lots of helpful things to say. And then when I was about to go up to Edinburgh, like last summer, I invited a few theatre type people to just watch me do a little sharing and just give some last minute feedback. It was too late for me to make big changes, but just give a bit of feedback. And I really liked what he said. And I was just
what
like,
did he say?
He asked me to think about movement and why I was doing things. His main thing is he likes to say, yeah, but why? I'm like, well, I want to do this. And he's like, yeah, but why? Oh, because this and this. Yeah, but why that? And it's like, he really makes you dig down into the actual core of what it is, why you're doing it. But also, I had worked with him before as a director, I forgot to say, in 2014 maybe. I did a project with a choir called Sense of Sound in Liverpool, and they wanted to make a theatre show. And they got him to direct that. And that ran, I think that ran for about a week or something like that. And I was in the show as a guest and as part of the story. And I really enjoyed working with him. So yeah, that trust's just there. And then also just everyone I said his name to has just been like, what, you're working with him? I'm like, yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, he's got a really strong reputation. So
yeah,
I'm really excited about it.
Great. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's been fun to talk to you.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Dusko Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Dusko Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.